Welcome to another edition of Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, we go another round with Matteo Garrone, the director of the hit Italian film Gomorra. Zan Brooks will be joining me to review this week's releases, including City of Ember with Bill Murray and Tim Robbins and psychological horror Mirrors, starring Kiefer Sutherland. Zan will also be revealing what you shouldn't ask Hollywood legend Faye Dunaway. But first, if you caught our Cannes coverage back in May, you'd know that one of the films I tipped for success this year was Italian film Gomorra, directed by Matteo Garrone. The film is based on Roberto Saviano's explosive exposé of the Camorra, or the Neapolitan Mafia, and how this particularly brutal tribe of mafiosi have permeated every facet of life in the Campania region. Garrone's previous films, The Taxidermist and most recently Primo Amore, failed to make an international splash, but Gomorra is scooping awards left, right and centre, having this week been put forward as Italy's offering for the best foreign language film at the Oscars. So when I met up with Matteo, I started out by asking him if he was surprised by the success of this dark portrayal of southern Italian dolce vita.
It's for me the first time, because it's my sixth movie, it's the first time that I make a movie that go well to the box office.
It's also done very well. Critics liked it. In England, I'm expecting a big success because the critics, me in particular, are a very, very big fan. But I see also that the Italian Academy has nominated your film to go forward to the US Academy for the Oscars. So you're going to be the Italian flag bearer in the world, in the film Olympics.
Yes. Anyway, it's not very elegant to talk about how good is them. So,
because it's interesting, it's not just you and the movie that have had a success. The coverage of the movie seems to me to be more relevant every day. Every day I'm looking, I see your movie stays in my head, and I read the newspapers. There's every day another story about the Camorra and about Naples and about the crime and about the different elements, if it's in bread baking or in mozzarella cheese, everywhere. It all comes back to your film, even Fashion Week, which is in Milan now, it seems to be related to it. So that it has a life beyond just the movie.
Yeah, that's true. And it's always difficult to understand which is the line between what really is happening now and what's on the past, but nobody talk about it. So it's probably I have the feeling that also in the past many things happening in that area, but nobody talk about it. Mm-hmm. And now, after the book of Roberto Saviano and after the movie, many things are changed, and so I'm happy about it.
You think they change for better or for worse?
No, they start to talk about it, as you said before. So we will see if we'll change in better, because that's the work of political men. So I don't know.
So you're saying you're not a political man?
No, not at all. And I don't believe, that's my personal opinion, that with the army, you can solve problem that are more deep, and I think that you can solve, you really can change, and also go against Camorra. The only way is from inside, trying to solve the problem from the real inside, like problem of education, problem of unemployment, all the reason that make a young boy become Camorrist.
You make it seem that in the world that you paint in your film Gomorra, that the boy has no option but to become a Camorrist. There is no way out, it seems to me, for the people in your world.
I wouldn't say that, but I should say that he can also don't go in the clan, but it's very easy if you grow up there, and you know, it's a kind of jungle, it's a kind of ecosystem, it's all very close.
Yes.
It's very easy to fall in some big mistake, because one of the things that I realized, I come from Rome and it's just 2 hours from Naples, but I didn't expect to to find a place in war in Italy in 2008. So I was the first to be surprised. And I thought was all black and white, the bad and the good, the camorrist bad and the citizen good that tried to survive on. And then when you arrived there, I discovered that there was a big gray zone where all is confused, illegal and illegal. And most of the people that I met, it was not conscious about their condition. They were not aware about their condition. So that's shocked me. That is all also the things that I try to give back to the audience with the movie. It's my surprise, without judge.
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. It works. It worked. And it's interesting you say it's like a jungle, because when I spoke to you in Cannes, one of the first things I said, and this is my reaction from my first viewing of the film, is how like animals your people were. They were always popping out of holes and hiding behind things. They were like little creatures of the night or in this environment. They made it their home.
Yeah, that's very, it's very animal. And, well, it was also a movie about the conflict, human conflict, of people that try to survive. So
Darwinian kind of law of the jungle here, the fittest survive, the lions survive.
Exactly. That's was the for me was, and also we wanted to make a movie not against Camorra, but about Camorra, to show how from inside it works.
Yeah.
And so, but from the emotional point of view,
I think this week, as you say, that the Camorra have fingers everywhere, you know, it goes into every system, even the finance system. And this week we're seeing the world's banks collapse. I'm sure the Camorra are probably okay. There's one man that he dies, the euro, he says, you know, fearing for this exchange mechanism that even the Camorra have some control over, I think.
Yeah, maybe. Saviano knows better than me about that. And another thing I think important that Saviano wrote in the book, and I found really true, that it's not the cinema that take inspiration from reality, but it's reality that take inspiration from cinema. So you can see a lot of people and a lot of criminal that is trying to imitate the character that they saw in the movie.
Yeah. You have Scarface in particular.
Yeah, but there is a scene that we shot in a big villa, dark villa. The scene I shot with the two boys that acting like Tony Montana in Scarface, that villa was the real villa of a real big boss named Schiavone that now is in jail. And this boss, when he made this villa, went to the architect with the tape of Scarface and asked to the architect, and he said, "I want the villa like Tony Montana." And he did it. So in the movie, you see the real villa made like Tony Montana villa in Scarface by a real boss.
So what's the reaction been to Gomorra? Because I know in Italy and in Cannes, when it first came out, there was a genuine sense, Matteo, that you could be in danger, that you needed protection. And that's the day I spoke to you. You looked a bit frightened, maybe. Maybe you needed protection from critics. I don't know. But I think it was a bit more dangerous than that. Was that a true danger? Was that a real danger that you felt?
Well, I was very worried at the beginning because, you know, Saviano is under protection, so could be dangerous. But then I think they realized that it was a movie that talked about their life, common people that live there. So they helped me to make the movie, and that was, I think, one of the strongest point of the movie. Because when we shot the scene, there were always about 50, 60 people behind the monitor. And they were the first audience of the movie. So for me, it was very important, their reaction. Also the discussion between there, if it's true that or not true. Or, as I told you before, there is a big gray zone, so you never know who is in the system, or who is out of the system, who is connected, our family, you know. So we work with the, we can say with the system, because it's a movie about system. It's about Camorra.
I wonder if the people in Naples or the Camorra themselves went to see your movie. Did they go and see it in the cinema, or did they all see it on pirate DVD?
Of course, pirate DVD. But with the pirate DVD, they make a lot of money, because there were thousands of pirate DVD the day after the movie was released.
The very brave Matteo Garrone there, out in public talking about Gomorrah, which is on UK-wide release from Friday, the 10th of October. Coming up on Film Weekly, Zan Brooks joins me to review the week's releases and to tell us of how Faye done away with him. But if you like Film Weekly, why not try this?
This Friday on Music Weekly, we talk to piano popsters Keane about rehab and coping with fame. Saint Etienne described the glory days of 90s London. And there's new music from Deer Hunter, EPMD and Grace Jones. Plus Michael Hannon's 60s pop group The Left Bank. That's all at guardian.co.uk/music.
You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, and I'm joined in the pod now by Zan Brooks, the roving Guardian film critic and reporter. Welcome back, Zan, from your Soaking with Faye Dunaway, more of which in a bit. Let's start with the week's releases, and let's start, of course, with Matteo Garrone, who we've heard from just now, the director of Gomorrah. I saw it in Cannes, you saw it in Cannes. Has it stayed with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is up there with Goodfellas in terms of sort of mafia movies. Yeah. And like Goodfellas, it basically shows it as a pretty grubby little bear pit. Pleasant thing. This isn't the Godfather. This isn't the sort of the nobility of it, the kind of the strange glamour. This is pretty down and dirty.
We're talking shell suits. We're talking fat blokes with guns. Yeah. We're talking messy stuff here.
We're talking teenagers who want to be Al Pacino but end up kind of running around the wetlands in their underpants, pretending that they're kind of mob bosses. It's a pretty sad and sordid sight, really.
So for people who haven't seen it, let's just describe the sort of experience they're going to get when they go to the cinema of it, because there's many threads here, many storylines all spinning like a Generation Game contestant. With
yeah, I think Saviano's book probably had many, many, many stories in it, but Garrone has sort of filleted it and taken five stories. And these five stories, you know, spin out from the teenagers who want to be Al Pacino to the elderly functionary who goes around sort of dispensing mafia money to kind of pacify the people on this kind of grubby estate outside of Naples. There's the sweatshop manager who's sort of doing designer label knockoffs. And most sort of disturbingly of all, there's the really seedy businessman who basically offers dumping ground for toxic waste. And you know, you could actually see this as a parable. I mean, it's a sort of with the suburb of Scampia as a kind of metaphor for the world that's kind of basically rotting and corrupt and contaminated.
Absolutely. Now, this is why I really like Gomorrah, because it is about everyday things that happens in the news all the time, but it also does kind of go out further. It is about corruption in everywhere. And kind of, you know, it's a prescient film, really, because it shows that systems are collapsing all around.
And systems are basically all based on a kind of gangsterism, that nobody actually, there's no kind of safeguards. There's no code of honour, really. It's just whatever people can get away with.
Because that's what, I mean, other mafia movies have done, and I don't know whether this is true, but I hear that the Sicilian mafia is much more about a code of honour and to do with omerta and to do with kind of blood feuds and all that, and that if you know, eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. So there is a kind of a morality, if you like, but this is amoral, this is chaos.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I'm not really au fait with it all, but I would imagine that the Sicilian mafia, that the sort of Catholic Church maybe plays a role in it, and it at least pays lip service to those kind of values, however corrupt those values might be. In Gomorrah, there's no sense of an abiding structure at all. I mean, it's a bear pit, it's a snake pit, and people are just clawing at each other.
And government seems to have no dominion and no point, and I mean, it's almost unrescuable, this.
Well, I mean, I'm sure the government have their fingers in a lot of these pies, so they're almost sort of tacitly letting it go on. And the implication is that there is no government, that basically, you know, it's every man for himself here.
Yeah, exactly. That perhaps is the government's view, is the Sodom, and this bit is Gomorrah.
Mm.
I really liked it as well because of the style of the film as well, which I thought
beautiful.
Was a new way. I mean, kind of documentary kind of aspect to it, but still, of course, some very grandstanding set pieces as well.
It's fantastic set pieces, and Garrone makes the most of his location. I mean, the suburb of Scampia is almost the main character in the film. Mm. And so he goes from these really kind of dark, Stygian kind of interiors to these great kind of explosions of colour when it gets outside, and it's bleak as hell, and yet it has a kind of beauty. That's not to say that this is a glamorous film about the mafia at all, but it certainly has a sort of visual impact.
Absolutely. I mean, the shots of the Scampia suburbs, these kind of, they're almost like Titanic size kind of council blocks.
Yeah, there's a sort of weird nautical flavour to them, isn't there? They're like these big ocean liners, kind of marooned.
Stranded and like they've been beached there, and the way that they're kind of decaying. We're used in sort of British cinema, of course, to seeing the council estate drama. This one, I think, takes those kind of and turns them on their head, actually, because these places become like jungles. I love the way that the people live in them, in the holes, and they climb around them like monkeys, and they that sort of ferrets and pop out of all the little crevices.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a sort of Darwinian flavour to this whole thing. I mean, you have the sense that Garrone isn't concentrating on the people at the top. He's concentrating on the wannabes and the functionaries and basically just the everyday working people too.
Man in his environment. That's Gomorrah. You heard from Matteo Falcone. That's Gomorrah. You heard from Matteo Garrone. I always call him Matteo Falcone because there's a Prosper Mérimée short story called Matteo Falcone about blood feud in Corsica. So that's my...
You didn't say that in the interview.
No, Mr. Falcone, why did you kill your son? No, Matteo Garrone there. And Zan Brooks and I really love Gomorrah. I mean, I think we're going to see this nominated at the Oscars.
I think so. I think there's a very good chance of it.
And I think maybe a winner. I don't know. It's the sort of thing that American
foreign
voters
foreign language
like.
Oscars always go to sort of surprise ones, don't they?
Yeah, no, they do. Well, they're usually about often sort of very kind of high-end Holocaust
movies.
Yes,
they do. I think it was the Counterfeiters one last year, which was perhaps a little more obviously moralistic than Gomorrah.
Yeah,
this
might be a sort of too bleak a view of life. But I thought there's humour in it as well. Anyway, let's move on to a film about another building that overtakes someone's life. It's Kiefer Sutherland as a security guard in a new film, Mirrors. Here he plays the security guard of a run-down, burnt-out department store where the mirrors start talking to him.
I'm seeing things. Bad things.
I'm not acting scared, but he is.
What are you doing?
Nothing.
I'm not the one looking into the mirrors, but they're looking back at me.
There's no one looking back at you through the mirrors.
Kiefer Sutherland there, Dan. We're used to seeing him as Jack Bauer, of course, in 24. He's kind of a good movie star, though, in these little
ones. I like him.
Ones.
I think, yeah, he is. And I particularly remember him from a very early Reese Witherspoon film from about 10 years ago called Freeway.
Oh, yes.
Which was a kind of weird spin on Little Red Riding Hood with Kiefer as the big bad wolf.
That was made by Matthew Bright, is it?
Yes,
is
that's right. Yeah, yeah. And he was very good in that. And he's pretty good in this, really. I mean, he plays a sort of broken down alcoholic ex-cop. With a whole hat full of troubles, even before he goes into the big department store and starts getting preyed on by kind of ghosts in the mirror. So, he does this well. I think the film itself is a little bit silly. I mean, it has creepy moments to it, but it's... You know, is it fair to accuse a film about ghosts in the mirror as being implausible?
Yeah, it is. But it is, as you say, he's got a hat full of problems. He's drunk. I've got his wife's leaving it. Yeah. You know, all these problems, and then he still takes this. And you think, well, mate, if I were you, with all your problems that you're taking pills, I wouldn't go down that dark passageway where the kind of drip drops are happening and where the mirrors are shattering and what's going on.
Yeah, but he still does it for the benefit of entertainment, I guess. This is based on a Korean film, as so many American horror films seem to be. These days. I haven't seen the Korean original, but this has a different director, and from what I've heard, it maybe doesn't have quite the power of the original movie. It also follows the real sort of poltergeist template here, because, you know, you've got the department store, which turns out to be an old mental institution, where, you know, the ghosts of the mental patients are running amok, which is a classic thing from Poltergeist, where the suburban housing estate is built on an old cemetery.
Yeah, exactly, and the dead have come back to
and then
their
you've got
revenge.
The kind of reclusive nun who eventually provides answers to the mystery.
I was kind of with it in that.
Yeah, I was kind of with
that recent John Cusack movie when he was trapped in a hotel room 1408, and Sam Jackson says, "Don't stay in that room," and he did, and I was kind of with it when he was in the building and that the mirrors were gone. But then I lost the logic when the ghost started following him to home and he had to go home and paint his kid's mirror so the kid stopped having nightmares.
Yeah.
And that didn't really make much sort of psychological sense.
It didn't make any sense at all. But, you know, I guess you could make the case that mirrors are inherently creepy. I mean, I think
Depends what you're looking at, mate.
Yeah, I find it creepy every morning. The best mirror movie, I think, for me is still the little segment in Dead of Night, you know, that old British portmanteau horror film from like the 1940s, where a guy looks into the mirror and sees a different room behind him that was, you know, and it's great. That's fantastic.
That was early like special effects.
It was fantastic. This Mirrors itself doesn't quite measure up.
Yeah, the kind of Korean horror or the J horror tropes that come back with all the water spilling out of a bath and black
water
hair.
And kind of household implements that go wrong, you know, whether it's the TV or your humble mirror. There's a sort of real paranoia within that culture, isn't there?
Yeah, well, they make the stuff. They know whence it comes. I was with it until he basically kind of kidnapped the kind of nun at gunpoint and did his 24, I'm Jack Bauer, I'm coming, don't make me threaten you, he said.
Yeah, I think maybe, is that in his contract that he has to do things like that?
I think so. And nevertheless, it is worth looking at him. I think he must have squeezed this in between, because he was rehab and he was in jail as well for alcoholism as well. I know we shouldn't bring up stars' lives, so you've had enough of that this week, Zan.
But maybe he brought it all to the park.
Yeah, I know. I think he did. I mean, it's worth watching for him. And in this sort of week, I think it's a rather strong film from Hollywood, at least, a kind of character study.
Yeah, but that's damning it with faint praise in a way, because this week, as we were saying before we began recording, has been a particularly bad week.
I know, this is the week where
movies.
The film critics come into their own. We see these films so you don't have to.
Well, the one film that I haven't seen that you have, which you maybe enlighten me on, is City of Ember.
That's right. It's a new film, actually, based on a kid's book, and it stars Bill Murray, and it stars Tim Robbins, and it stars Harry Treadaway and Oscar nominee Saoirse Ronan. She, who was the little girl in Atonement, here she is. She's been made a messenger in this new land of City of Ember.
It's beautiful.
Wear it proudly. Your station is Garland Square.
Stop!
I need to tell you the rules. One, when a customer...
gives you a message, repeat it back to make sure you've got it right. Two, always wear the red cape so people can identify you. Three, our customers pay 20 coins for every message, no matter how far we have to carry it. So go fast. I love going fast.
Very good. I'm impressed. Now go!
So, Jason, this is certainly a fantastic cast in this, isn't it? I mean, this is the sort of cast that you'd get for an A-list Oscar hopeful.
Well, I assume that there was something very big in Hollywood about this film. I know Tim Robbins has been on telly saying, well, he did this movie. We don't see a lot of Tim Robbins.
No, we don't.
It? And he did it because he's got kids and he was fed up of taking them to see, I presume, films about talking animals. So this is a fantastical little kind of land that's been built out of rubbish. I think humanity's ended in some way. I always never get when these films start. There's another one out this week called Mutant Chronicles that start with, in 2007, and all these weird things have happened, and the last colony on Earth.
And there was Death Race a couple of weeks ago that had exactly the same thing.
But I noticed in these...
It's a sign of the times.
You can still smoke in all of these places, so that hasn't
been...
Well,
if the world's ended, you're not going to give up smoking, are you?
So anyway, they're still going away in the City of Ember. They're working away. I'm not really sure what was going on in this film. It seemed like a lot of it had been chopped out and edited so that it came down to like a nice 93 minutes. If scenes happen very quickly. Even the set piece scenes, I didn't quite get why people were running away from who they were running away from. That said, Bill Murray is very good as the mayor, as you'd expect him to be. He looks very, very bored and fed up with the whole thing. But that's what you want Bill Murray to do, especially in a kid's film. He's definitely thinking, I'm taking the money here. I shouldn't be doing this. I was in Caddyshack, for goodness sake. What am I doing in this nonsense? But I must say that it's very good to see lots of British actors in it. Toby Jones is in there. Mm-hmm. Harry Treadaway, who was one of the twins in The Brothers of the Head, that film about the rock stars, and Saoirse Ronan as well. They're all doing all right in it, but then a lot of very sort of eccentrics turn up in it. Liz Smith, who's the grandma in the royal family, she's here surrounded by lots of knitting going mad. Martin Landau pops up. Who was a wonderful actor, even though Space 1999 is probably what he's most famous for. I remember him very very well from Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Brilliant.
Isn't he just fantastic in that? Well, here he's playing a part that I think should have gone to Christopher Lloyd, the bloke from Taxi and Back to the Future.
Yeah.
But he must be busy or something.
Do you think he's busy?
He might be busy.
He doesn't seem to be busy.
Well, he should have a go at Martin Landau. But yes, exactly. How busy can you be?
But who's the audience for a film like this? I mean, is it targeting kind of smaller children? Is it trying for the sort of adult crossover?
I think it's looking at teens, but right. my feeling is that it's too eccentric and not kind of cool enough for teens as well. It's kind of, probably it works really well. I haven't read the book, but someone told me it was a really beautiful book. So I imagine it's the sort of book that, you know, you read, you have your own reading of the way it's been described and everything. And then a director called Jill Kennan has come along, and he did Monster House, which I thought was a really good animation.
I liked
it as well. So I think there was a lot of pressure, you know, behind him and built up, and Tom Hanks was the executive producer here. So there's kind of a sort of Hollywood aspect to it. And they said, yeah, give Jill Kennan the, and he's kind of made this fantastical sort of Heath Robinson-esque kind of world where it's kind of full of bits of sticky back plastic and rickety wooden things, and yet these are kind of amazing inventions happen. And I can imagine that it's always disappointing when someone else has imagined it and it doesn't look like you imagined it. So I think it was a big bestseller amongst that teen audience, but whether they'll go and see that, because there's no one really cool.
Yeah, they're not going to say, you know, I can't imagine teenagers saying, I'm going to go see this film. It's got Tim Robbins and Martin Landau.
Yeah,
in it.
Exactly. So I think it's kind of going to kind of that City of Embers will glow for a little while and then kind of be put out quite quickly. But Zan, actually, quid pro quo, you've seen a film this week that I haven't seen, a film called Tuesday.
Yeah, I think we should swap. City of Embers sounds more interesting than Tuesday was.
You got nothing on me. This ain't the movies, herbs, so stop talking in cliche. This ain't the movies, it's a cliche.
Why don't you tell us what happened?
Good cop, bad cop, that's a cliche.
Who says we're not both bad cops?
But one argue with you there.
I wanted to rob the bank to get some money. Ironic, isn't it? The day I choose to rob this bank, someone else is robbing it.
Tuesday is yet another of these British heist thrillers, this time kind of openly and brazenly played as farce. And also there's some brazen casting going on in here as well, because it's got John Sim and Philip Glenister, who are obviously together in Life on Mars, which was very good.
Oh, the telly thing, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, they're back together. So some you know, industrious producer has obviously thought, you know, we can get these two and put them back and we'll hopefully get a kind of spillover from the Life on Mars audience coming to see this. They've also said it in the 1980s. I don't quite know why. It doesn't make a great play of the 1980s necessarily, but nevertheless,
how they signify the 80s. I'm always intrigued.
There's a few shoulder pads kicking around in there, and a few, you know, references to Sheena Easton and people like that.
It's as good as that, is it?
That's as far as it goes. And it's basically about kind of three different outfits trying to rob a bank.
Outfits as in shoulder pads and piano
everything.
Keyboard ties. Oh, okay.
So that's how it goes. And it also does the thing that can be very clever, or it can be a terrible crutch where it breaks up the time frame. So you think, what's going on here? Oh, that might be explained later on. And it basically is a sort of way, it's almost like kind of the equivalent of hot wiring a car to kind of get it going. And it's all a little bit disposable. It's not to say it's rubbish, because, you know, the acting is okay, some of the sort of banter is all right, but it's not great.
And why is it called Tuesday? Is that when the heist is happening?
That's when the heist is happening. And ingeniously, the S in Tuesday is actually a pound sign.
Yeah, I saw
to show that.
That
there's money involved.
Yeah.
You see?
Do you think it might have worked if it was a dollar sign a bit better?
It might have done, or a euro even, but then they couldn't have set it in the 1980s.
No, of course. So that's huge. Is there a soundtrack with Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran, etc.?
There is a sort of intermittent contemporary soundtrack. There's a sort of fairly nice-ish twist at the end that I couldn't quite see coming. But it's still very, very throwaway.
Okay, that's Tuesday, Zan. This week, Zan, you've done something to overshadow all of this, apart from maybe Gomorrah, and that's interview Faye Dunaway. First of all, why were you interviewing Faye Dunaway?
Because Faye Dunaway agreed to be interviewed by The Guardian. I don't think she will again. And it was all incredibly short notice. I had to sort of fly across town to the Dorchester. And it was a bit of a disaster.
It wasn't even a bit of a disaster.
It was a car crash of monumental proportions.
Oh, Zan. Now, she's here with a film, isn't she, at the Raindance Film Festival. Did you see that film?
Yes. She's in a film called Flick, which is a very strange film to see her in. It's a Welsh-set British horror movie. in which she plays a one-armed cop who's over from Memphis on the trail of a zombie teddy boy.
Right. Now, this that would suggest to me that she might have some sense of humour, because it's a film that she's done a series of quite low-budget films over the last few years, but not many. It would suggest to me that she's obviously got some sense of humour, but obviously you met her and she
may well have a sense of humour. She may well have a sense of humour, and also there's something endearing about her doing this film and agreeing to promote it, and, you know, help out these small-time filmmakers who you know, obviously need a leg up, and they've got a kind of genuine Hollywood legend sort of appearing in their film. So all that is to her credit, and maybe the whole interview is to my discredit, because I asked the question that must not be asked.
Now you can ask me that question. What was the question that you asked Faye Dunaway?
Do you know, I was given a list of questions that she would not ask. This wasn't on that list. It was a question relating to her reputation as something of a diva, and it was a question relating specifically to events on the set of Chinatown. And there is a story going around that's been widely reported and was written up in the Peter Biskin book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Absolutely.
At one stage, she was so infuriated by Roman Polanski that she threw a cupful of urine at him. I asked her if this was true. She flared up and ended the interview straight away.
And now, how did she do it? She just said, I'm not asking you.
She said it was insulting. She said that she was a lady. She said it was distasteful. She said that I had purposely intended to insult her, which genuinely I was not trying to insult her. I was just trying to get her take
on this. It is one of those great Hollywood stories, though, isn't it? I mean, I've known about this story since reading Peter Biskin's book, and I've always thought Faye Dunaway... urine. They become kind of in my head.
Well, this is the thing. This is kind of how I'm justifying it, in that these stories do the rounds. Maybe they're urban legends. Maybe there's no truth in them at all. But I kind of think it's better that if you have Faye Dunaway sitting across from you, to just ask her rather than just carry on repeating the story.
Would you ask Richard Gere about gerbils?
I wouldn't now. I wouldn't now. I think my next interview is going to be endless questions that are a variation on why are you so wonderful.
Because rather bravely, you've now gone online, and you can see this at guardian.co.uk/film, to sort of say, wait, I feel Faye Dunaway cancelled my interview after a little while. I mean, you got something out of her. And was I right to ask this question? And you've attracted some vitriol.
Yeah, the overwhelming response is no, I wasn't right.
Yeah, but I see there are a few people who have supported you. I mean, as an interviewer myself, I mean, I tend to kind of, I would have buttered her up a little more, I think, before I asked her this question.
I should have come to you for advice.
No,
it's a very, it's a very tricky, you know, terrain that we tread. If it's so easy to just do the why are you so wonderful, why are you so wonderful, and you come out with an incredibly bland interview.
Which you were getting. I mean, wasn't really answering.
Well, I was asking about her reputation, and she was basically implying that there was no rumours about her reputation at all, that she had no reputation and she couldn't think what I meant. So, you know, that's disingenuous of her, I think. I think that she could have at least said, yes, I know that these things are written about me. They're not true because blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But she wasn't even biting on that at all.
Now, what about the Mummy Dearest thing? Because that was one of the prescribed questions, wasn't it? You weren't supposed to ask about Mummy Dearest, which I can't believe, because I think it's one of her most famous portrayals.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's her problem with Mummy Dearest?
Well, it's credited with sort of derailing her career at the time. She went from winning an Oscar for Network to winning a Golden Raspberry for playing Joan Crawford in Mummy Dearest. And obviously she's so furious about the reception to that film still that she will not talk about it.
And now, is this because she was trashing Hollywood royalty in Joan Crawford?
It was seen as a sort of scenery-chewing performance.
Yeah, which it is slightly banal.
Which it kind of is, but it's sort of appropriate for the film. And it's a film that I kind of happen to sort of have a sneaking, you know, affection for.
No wire hangers. I mean, it's one of the key lines of all time in Hollywood.
I know. So she obviously has a big problem with the press, and she obviously has a big problem with how she's perceived. And I think I probably have exacerbated that.
So how long into the interview was it when you asked the question?
This was about 25 minutes in.
And you were scheduled
I was scheduled for an hour. I was kind of rattling through the questions, though, because she wasn't really responding to the other questions.
Yeah, no, I got
questions.
That from really. So what happens when someone cancels an interview and she says, no more?
That? Well, actually, I mean, I was thinking about this. I don't think it's ever happened to me. I mean, I've had interviews that have kind of wrapped up a little awkwardly and embarrassingly, but I've never actually been thrown out of the hotel. And it was peculiarly awful. I mean, I felt embarrassed. I felt kind of mortified.
Because what? Because she's Faye Dunaway? Because she's a Hollywood legend? Because you fancied her in a pillbox hat and Thomas Brown
probably
affair?
All those things a little bit. But I think I was just kind of shocked. I was a little stunned. And she was so damn angry. So it really was a case of me apologising.
Did you say no? Really sorry. We'll take that again. We can start again. Or you just had
no.
To
there start... was no. There, that wasn't an option. She was up from her chair, across the room, and on the phone to
security.
Exactly, pretty much. I ended up fleeing down the fire escape.
Oh no! Well, if you ever make the film of How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, the sequel, we can put you in there with Toby Young.
Fingers crossed.
Zan Brooks there, and you can read Zan's Faye Dunaway interview in full by going to guardian.co.uk/film. Well, that's all we've got for you this week. Thanks again to Zan Brooks and to Matteo Garrone. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. Read my trailer trash column and my preview of the London Film Festival. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.